From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The most eloquent visionary of the American Revolution was Thomas Paine. Now, his first book, Common Sense, sold a couple of 100,000 copies in a country that was the population, what, 3, 4, 5 million? Would have been a bestseller for years. But during Rights of Man, the second one, is when he said, demagogues love to confuse, deliberately confuse, reason with treason, either with me or against us. In a sense, very contemporary indeed.
He's one of the great social historians of our time. He prefers to call himself a guerrilla journalist with a tape recorder. Today, an hour with the legendary broadcaster and Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Studs Terkel. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. is continuing a major assault in western Iraq. At least 3,500 U.S. troops are taking part in two separate offensives. Operation Rivergate was launched at the start of the holy month of Ramadan. It marks the biggest U.S. offensive in western Iraq this year. Blasts from U.S. warplanes and helicopters lit up the sky during the fighting. 42 Iraqis were reportedly killed today. Meanwhile, at least 5 U.S. soldiers have died since Monday. Colonel Stephen Davis, commander of Marine Regimental Combat Team 2, is warning residents in the region that the U.S. will be there for a while. He told a crowd of Iraqis, quote, "We're not going anywhere. Some of you are concerned about the attack helicopters and mortar fire from the base. I will tell you this. Those are the sounds of peace," he said. Meanwhile, under pressure from the United Nations and United States, the Shiite-led Iraqi government has reversed last-minute changes that it made to the rules for the October 15th vote on the Constitution. On Sunday, the parliament had made changes that would have made it nearly impossible for the Sunni minority to defeat the charter at the polls. In Washington, President Bush held a daytime news conference Monday and spent much of the time defending his selection of Harriet Myers as his nominee to the Supreme Court.
I picked the best person I could find. People know we're close. But you got to understand, because of our closeness, I know the character of the person. It's one thing to say a person can read the law, and that's important, and understand the law. But what also matters, Adam, is the intangibles. You know, to me, a person's strength of character counts a lot. And as a result of my friendship with Harriet, I know her strength of character. It's important to me, again, I repeat to you, I don't want to put somebody on the bench who's this way today and changes. That's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in finding somebody who shares my philosophy today and we'll have that same philosophy 20 years from now.
President Bush speaking at his news conference Tuesday. The selection of Harriet Myers has been widely criticized by conservatives because so little is known about her personal politics. She's never served as a judge. Later in the news conference, President Bush said he did not recall ever sitting down with Myers to discuss her view on abortion. But a former colleague of Myers says her stance on abortion is clear. Lorley Bartos, who ran Myers' 1989 campaign for Dallas City Council, said, quote, "She's on the extreme end of the anti-choice movement. I think Harriet's belief was pretty strongly felt. I suspect she's of the same cloth as the president," she said. At the same news conference, President Bush was questioned about the ongoing investigation into the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. On Sunday, ABC News host George Stephanopoulos said his sources told him President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney were involved in the discussions about Plame. Meanwhile, The Washington Post has reported Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald may be planning to bring criminal conspiracy charges against White House officials, possibly Karl Rove and Louis Libby. On Tuesday, Bush refused to answer whether he had discussed the case with Rove or Libby.
Getting back to the leak investigation just for a moment, I'm curious, sir, whether you have any conversations with any of your aides, particularly Karl Rove or Scooter Libby, about any of their dealings with reporters poking around on that issue and any strategy that they may have come up with to deal with that issue.
The special prosecutor made it very clear early in the process that those of us in the White House should not discuss the case. publicly or privately.
President Bush at his news conference. For the second time in 2 months, a prominent conservative television host has called for the assassination of a foreign leader. Fox News host Bill O'Reilly said the U.S. should consider assassinating Syrian President Bashar al-Assad if he fails to help the United States with a war in Iraq.
And we should take his life if he doesn't help us out. Iran, different nut.
That was Fox News host Bill O'Reilly. In August, televangelist Pat Robertson called for the assassination of the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, during a broadcast of his show, The 700 Club. On news about Hurricane Katrina, the New York Times is reporting the vast majority of those killed in the hurricane remain unnamed. Of the 972 deaths confirmed in Louisiana, the state has made the names of only 32 victims public. This is in stark contrast to Mississippi, where 221 people have been confirmed dead and all but 25 have been identified. Critics say this has prevented the public from having a personal connection to those killed in the storm. Meanwhile, the Government Accountability Office is being asked to investigate whether minority-owned businesses have been given a fair opportunity to compete for Hurricane Katrina reconstruction contracts. Republican Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine and Congressmember Donald Manzullo, an Illinois Republican, called for the investigation Tuesday. So far, the Federal Emergency Management Agency has awarded $1.6 billion in contracts, but less than 2% of the contracts have gone to minority-owned businesses. This despite the fact that the region has a higher percentage of black and minority-owned businesses than other areas of the country. Following the hurricane, the Bush administration waived government contracting rules that required at least 5% of government contracts to go to minority-owned businesses. Rules forcing contractors to pay prevailing wages have also been waived. Harry Alford, president of the National Black Chamber of Commerce, said, quote, "What they're basically saying to the minority in New Orleans is, we'll make it harder for you to find a job, and if you do, we'll make sure you get paid less." In Iraq, CorpWatch is reporting tens of thousands of low-wage Asian laborers are traveling to Iraq to work for U.S. military contractors like Halliburton. Monthly salaries usually range from $200 to $1,000, far less than the salaries paid to U.S. contractors. Many of the workers are coming from the Philippines, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Nepal, and Pakistan. CorpWatch reports they frequently sleep in crowded trailers and wait outside in line in 100-degree-plus heat to eat slop. Many are said to lack adequate medical care and put in hard labor 7 days a week, 10 hours or more a day, for little or no overtime pay. They're also often unprotected from the ongoing fighting. When U.S. contractors slip on helmets and bulletproof vests, the Asian laborers are frequently shielded only by the shirts on their backs. The number of Asian laborers killed since the war began is unknown. This news from Iran. The Iran Student News Association has just released a new photo showing the hanging of two gay teenagers aged 18 and 17. Independent journalist Doug Ireland reports the boys were charged with rape, but they were actually the victims of an increasing crackdown on the country's gay population. Prior to their execution, the teens were held in prison for over a year and tortured. Ireland reports this anti-gay crackdown is part of the crusade against, quote, moral corruption promised by Iran's newly elected president, Ahmadinejad, in his election campaign. Last month, Ireland interviewed a 22-year-old gay Iranian man who is seeking asylum in Turkey. While in Iranian police custody, he was beaten and tortured, threatened with death, and lashed 100 times. And in news from Iraq, Reporters Without Borders is marking the start of Ramadan by calling for the United States to release five detained journalists, all of whom are working for foreign press outlets. Abdel Amir Yunus Hussein, a cameraman with CBS News, has been held since April 5th. Journalist Amar Daham Naif Khalaf, who works for Agence France-Presse, has been detained since April 11th. Cameraman Samer Mohammed Noor and Ali Omar Abraham al-Mashadani of the British press agency Reuters have been held since June 4th and August 8th, respectively. And correspondent Hamid Majed of Al Arabiya has been detained since September 15th. Reporters Without Borders said all the journalists have been denied access to a lawyer and the right to receive a visit from their families or their employers. And that's some of the news. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. He's one of the great social historians of our time. He prefers to call himself a guerrilla journalist with a tape recorder. I'm talking about the legendary broadcaster and Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Studs Terkel. Born in 1912 in New York City, Studs moved with his family to Chicago at the age of 10, where he spent most of his life. Over the years, he's worked as an activist, a civil servant, a labor organizer, a radio DJ, and a television actor. But he's best known as a Chicago radio personality and the Pulitzer Prize-winning author. For 45 years, Studs Terkel has spent an hour each weekday on his nationally syndicated radio show, interviewing the famous and the not-so-famous. With his unique style, he creates portraits of everyday life in America and chronicles the changing times of the 20th century. The Chicago Historical Society is now creating the Studs Terkel Center for Oral History, where people will be able to listen to over 5,000 hours of taped interviews. In 1956, Studs Terkel published his first book, The Giants of Jazz. Since then, he's written many more, including his famed Working and The Good War, which won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction. His latest book, just published, is entitled And All They Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey. It's a collection of interviews with a wide range of legendary American musicians, from Leonard Bernstein to Janis Joplin, Bob Dylan to Louis Armstrong. Studs Terkel recently underwent open heart surgery, and at 93 years old, his surgeon says he's the oldest person he knows to have successfully undergone the risky procedure. Studs Terkel will spend the hour with us today in our firehouse studio, as he did 2 years ago, and we are thrilled to have you back.
Well, I'm so delighted, Amy, just to be with you and an old firehouse. You know, as you were reading the news, I thought of one thing, a burlesque house, burlesque, the hotel in which I was raised during my young manhood in Chicago, had several burlesque houses around, First and Second Bananas, and George Bush is a perfect second banana. The second banana is the one who is fed the stuff and who's a natural foil for the first banana, who would be Karl Rove. But they're not as funny as the burlesque shows I saw. I think of people who were considered idols in our society. Ronald Reagan, for example, was voted the greatest leader this country's ever had by 4.5 million people, Discovery Channel. You start thinking, And where did Lincoln figure? And where did FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, figure? A bragging 10th. And you start thinking of something. There is no past. We're suffering from a national Alzheimer's disease. So if there's no remembrance of yesterday, as will be the case, how can they remember something happened 70 years ago? For example, the disaster, the catastrophe, Katrina in New Orleans. We know now that the government was unprepared for it. We could see a movie right now, a documentary that was filmed during the New Deal. It's called The River, and it was the government stepping in to prevent floods, and Tennessee Valley Authority came out of it. The music was Virgil Thompson. One other thing, before I let you go, say a word.
You said you can keep talking.
You said 1912. That's the year the Titanic went down, I came up. But also,
This is the year you were born.
1912, and I was reminded of this by Leonard Bernstein in the recent book, why he was so generous-hearted, as well as so multi-gifted. He said New York City wanted to celebrate his 75th birthday with a gigantic ceremony. He says, no, I'll be in Lawrence, Massachusetts, my hometown. In 1912, immigrant women, mostly Italian and Portuguese, went on strike against the Boston Brahmins who exploited them in the textile mills. Out of it came that song, Bread and Roses. And so Bernstein spent the celebration of his life in his hometown. Gives you an idea of the kind of guy he was.
Studs, Speaking about the kind of guy you are, just physically, your doctor's saying you're the oldest person to successfully undergo this heart operation. First of all, you're looking very good in your red and white checked shirt and your red socks.
Now, the story behind that, you see, I had broken my neck earlier. And before that, about 9 years ago, I had, when I was much younger, 85 or so, I had a quintuple bypass. By the way, there's a moral to this whole thing. I had a quintuple bypass and passed, and I have no longer used the nitro sublingual pill. Now, my two brothers and my father all died in their 50s, and I was due because I had angina. So I overcame that, and it was my stubbornness. But then came this book called, subtitled, The Adventures of a Dyslectic Disc Jockey.
Yeah, right.
Of an Eclectic Disc Jockey, and they all sang. That's a Bernstein phrase, by the way. People sang more as well as talked more before technology took over. He's not condemning technology. He's merely saying something's happened to Vox Humana. And so they're celebrating. This is a year ago, July 4th. My neighbors are going to have a cocktail party for me because the book is due out. But I slip down a stairway, and I do a tour jeté, but I don't land on point. It was something not choreographed by Balanchine, but by Bob Fosse, because it was jazzy, except that my head hit the thing, and I was in the hospital with a broken neck. Now things going along okay. I'm getting along. When 5 weeks ago, October 5th, about 6 weeks ago, I was told by the cardiologist, my family doctor, who, by the way, is a leading advocate of national health, and the surgeon, that unless I had a new valve put in, I'm gone in about 3-4 months. And I said, the hell with it. Okay, I might as well. I'm 93. But then curiosity got the best of it. And my curiosity is what saw me through. What would the world be like? Or will there be a world? And so that's my epitaph. I have it all set. Curiosity did not kill this cat. And it's curiosity, I think, that has saved me thus far.
So how are you feeling?
Not bad. Considering everything, not bad at all. Or nurses would say, as well as it can be expected. No, not half bad, really. I can talk, obviously.
Well, you're looking great, and it's great.
By the way, do you know, remember the seven ages? You said, I'm looking great. You know the seven ages of man, of course, melancholy Jaques, the seven ages. There are three ages today. There's youth, old age, and you're looking great. Yes, ma'am.
Studs Terkel is our guest. I wanted to read the first few lines of your book. And they all sang. 1945, early autumn, month before World War II had ended with a flash and a bang. 4 Sundays later, I began as host of a one-hour weekly radio program of recorded music called The Wax Museum. The phrase disc jockey had not yet entered our working vocabulary. In effect, though, that is what I was, you write, The Wax Museum, because...
Well, the records were shellac, and there was a waxen bass. You drop it, and they crack. I still have a lot of 78s at home. And who was the figure who really created the record industry? There was one artist, Enrico Caruso. See, every immigrant family, not just Italian, of course, or Jewish families, but every immigrant family of Eastern Europe, all would buy a Caruso record. It was $2 a piece. It would be equivalent to about $50 today. And they'd listen. And his voice, John Chardy, the poet, says, something about his voice really accentuated the possibilities that are in all people in society. We can go one step higher. And that's what he would do. Caruso, say, in the aria from O Paradiso, the opera, Vasco da Gama and his discoveries. And he's reached the top. And suddenly he goes further. So some of those interviews are 50, 60 years old. And a couple of the divas in the book sang with Caruso. And they spoke of that experience with him. And so in a way, I'd go from Caruso. The word is eclectic, this jockey. Caruso say to Louis Armstrong's West End Blues, my favorite jazz record, with Earl Hines playing a trumpet-style piano. And from there I'd go to Woody Guthrie doing Tom Joad. In 6 minutes, two sides of a 10-inch record, he covered The Grapes of Wrath. I mean, he covered the novel of John Steinbeck, didn't miss a bet when it came to the highlights, when he says goodbye to his mother at the end. She'll know where I am. You'll know where I am. Wherever kids are hungry, I'll be there. Wherever guys are beaten up, I'll be there. And Woody did that. Then I go into another recording, opera it might be, or something else. And one of the reasons I did that, I didn't realize it till now, is because classical music, by a lot of working people, is considered beyond them. See, they read the tabloid, or they maybe see first night women with tiaras and guys with gloves and cane. And so they thought maybe it's for them. Maybe Mahler and Bach are for them. But there's one guy in a book called Aikenfeld, a wonderful novel. Not a novel. It's sort of a oral history of a small town near London. And this working man says, it's not for me, really. It's beyond me. One day to get out of the rain, he wanders into this hall. It could be in Manchester. And he hears music, and it's Mozart. And he listens, and he listens. He says, I like this. I like this. It is, I am good enough for it. And so in a sense, that's what it's about too. The possibilities that we have for the better angels to take over. And we do have that. You know, you call the Pollyanna because you still have hope. That's one of the books there, isn't it? What was that called? Hope Dies Last. That's a book earlier.
Keeping the faith in troubled times.
People such as yourself. I call them part of the prescient minority, the prophetic minority. They were there during the Jefferson-Adams fight, Alien Sedition Acts, 11 years after the French Revolution. They were called Jacobins. And during slavery days, they were called abolitionists. And they paid their dues and they got their lumps. And during World War I, Eugene V. Debs went to prison because he was against the war. And it was a Democratic president put him in, Woodrow Wilson. Do you know who pardoned him? Warren Gamaliel Harding. Would you believe it? Sometimes it's the individual himself, herself, who might be it. And you were talking, well, I'm sorry.
We have to break. But when we come back, I want to ask you about Joe McCarthy and J. Edgar Hoover. I want to ask you about Louis Armstrong and Mahalia Jackson, maybe a little about James Baldwin. Stay with us.
Mahalia Jackson.
move on up a little higher. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, we are broadcasting on over 375 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and NPR and low-power FM stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV, Channel 375. We're podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are in Spanish, and audio and transcript, and today, the video and the audio of today's broadcast, as well as the transcript of our interview with Studs Terkel, will be there, right there at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning author, broadcaster, legendary social historian Studs Terkel. We're just listening to Mahalia Jackson. How did you meet her?
Oh, I was in a music shop one day, and I heard this Apollo label record, break of a record, two sides, move on up a little higher. And then I heard it in many black communities, not white. I was the white. See, to this day, it's a sad commentary. I'm considered among whites the guy who discovered Mahalia Jackson, because I was the white disc jockey who played her, having heard her sing this very song, move on up a little higher. And that voice, you know, was something, the Welsh would say, something special. It was. And so that's a, the irony is the African-American community knew who she was. The whites didn't. I happened to be a white disc jockey. And so I've been associated with her name. I did. I was the host of her radio show later. That's a funny story.
Tell
about
it.
Her. And, well, I was kicked off TV. Chicago was the home of early pioneer TV back in 1949, 1950. It was on 6 to 10 at night. There were three programs, Dave Garraway, and he's the first host of the show called Today, a revolutionary program that was daytime, never was morning show, ever. He was the most famous face in the world at one time. Dave Garraway was a fellow disc jockey of mine. And that's Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, a puppet show. And the genius of TV, Chicago TV, was Bert Tilstrom, little rags in his hand. A one-toothed dragon, a little kukla, which is Russian for doll, and a woman, an actual woman, Fran Allison. And he was so remarkable. He'd create a little rags in his hand, a whole community of tenderness. The third program was Studs Place. And all of us had something in common. We improvised. There was no soundtrack. The dialogue was by the cast. And I had three colleagues. And now and then another person would be the catalyst for the plot, which is a very simple one. And then I got in trouble. Then Joe McCarthy comes along and John Edgar Hoover, and I sign. My name is on all these attorney generals' lists, organizations, anti-fascist refugee committee. Following the Spanish Civil War, there were refugees, went to South America, to France, and it's backing them. And there was my name. And in the meantime, I'm hot property, I should point out, that I was courted by New York agents and others. Mike Wallace was an announcer in Chicago, and he came there. And I was courted very much. And then they come in from New York. The guy says, we're in trouble. I'm going out to sort of Lone Ranger. Where do you get that we stuff, says Tonto to him. And he said, don't you know that these are commie organizations? And that's when I get kind of cute. And I said, suppose communists come out against cancer. Do we have to automatically come out for cancer? He said, that's not very funny. And I said, you got to stand up and be counted. Well, I love Charlie Chaplin. So I stood up, as Charlie Chaplin would do. He said, that's not funny either. So either you recant or we can you. So they canned me. And so I'm not working for a while. Meantime, the Legionnaires are after me. But Chicago is a city I love, because every woman's club that hired me, say for $100, to talk about folk music, talk about jazz, not one canceled. But one elderly, elegant woman who was the head of the hiring of this ladies' club was so furious at this Legionnaire who wrote them this frightening letter that I was dangerous and they'd be under the gun if they hired me. She said, I'm going to double your fee to 200, 100. And so I sent this guy, now gone to the great Legion post beyond the sky. So I said to him, I didn't say anything. I sent a letter to him with a $10 check. I said, I owe you commissions, $10 for the extra 100. He never acknowledged my check. Now here's where Mahalia comes in. Meantime, Mahalia gets to be world-renowned, and CBS offers her a radio contract for the whole network. And she'll do it on one condition, that Studs Terkel, as she put it, is the host of the show. And they trembled a bit, but said, fine. It's done in a theater, Wrigley Building Theater, CBS, and I warm up the audience, and I work closely with Mahalia. Well, sure enough, a guy comes in, another guy from New York, this time at CBS, during a dress rehearsal, before the audience comes in. It's on the network, you know. During the dress rehearsal, he comes in and says, would you mind signing this? It's pro forma. That's, I am not, nor have I ever been, and I'm loyal. I said, I don't believe in that stuff. My yea is my yea, my nay is my nay, as the brethren would put it. I'm not, he says, oh, you got to. Mahalia hears that. And she's going toward the piano, because I remember we were getting a new theme song. What's the one that Ethel Waters used to sing in that play? I'll think of it tomorrow. His eye is on the sparrow, and I know he watches me. She hears this argument, and she says, is that what I think it is? She knows about me. She says, Studs, you know, you got such a big mouth, you should have been a preacher. And so she says, let's rehearse. He says, Miss Jackson, this is from New York, and Mr. Terkel has to sign this. And she says, look, if you fire Studs, find another Mahalia Jackson. You know what happened? Nothing. Nothing happened. We went through as per schedule, meaning the emperor has no clothes. Somebody said no. Mahalia said no. And that's the story. Simple as that.
I want to play an excerpt of an interview you did with Mahalia Jackson, but it starts with a little of Mahalia's voice.
Move on up a little higher. Meet old man Danger. Move on up a little higher. Meet the Hebrew children.
Mahalia Jackson, our guest this morning. Mahalia, I'm thinking about you and this song. Now, I've known you since about 1946. That'd be about 17 years we've known one another, Mahalia.
That's right.
I'm thinking about this song. Your recognition as an internationally known artist, a black woman, a singer of gospel songs, spirituals.
Mm-hmm.
What does this song, what meaning does this song have for you today?
Well, you got to keep moving, and you got to have heart, and you got to just suffer, but you got to keep on moving, because the world is, there's so many people is trying to move. They got to just keep pushing their way, and then there's so many people is ready to move, ready to come up out of poverty, come up out of oppression, and that's the meaning of it. You're trying to tell the world you got to have a real heart, a real soul, a real feeling of love in your heart, and only love can do this. If when you keep trying to move, you got to move on to success and to love each other.
Well, this is in a way, I suppose, what Reverend Martin Luther King's feeling is all about, because the nonviolent movement. That it's pretty difficult, though, isn't it, Mahalia? I mean,
no.
Isn't this difficult?
It's so sad. It's so sad.
Difficult to you can't turn. It's rough to turn a cheek, isn't it?
Oh. Well, that's his teaching, you know, and I have gone along with it pretty much, and following his leadership. But you know, it's pretty hard, Stud, for somebody to keep on knocking you down, and he keeps saying to stick to it. I know he's right, But you kind of get a little angry there, you know. Yeah. And especially when they put the little children in the jail and putting dogs on people. Only thing we are interested in is equal rights, where we can make a living to survive, you understand, and to have an education. Only the grace of God that has brought me thus far, being an unlearned woman, not able. And what was I going to try to learn for down there? It was no work for me. If I'd have got a chance to go to college, there was nothing for me to do but still push the white people's buggy, their babies, and clean their babies and clean their house. It's just since I've been up north, a little bit of opportunities open. That's another thing that puzzles me. I don't know, this thing, it's peculiar.
We've been listening to Mahalia Jackson, your interview, 1963.
Oh, yeah, that was it. But, you know, you mentioned spirituals and gospel. Now, there's a difference, you see. I interviewed, in that book, interviewed Professor Thomas Dorsey, not Tommy Dorsey, Thomas Dorsey, who's the father of gospel music. He was once known as Georgia Tom. And he accompanied Ma Rainey, who was the teacher of Bessie Smith. And when his wife died, he was saved, found salvation. And gospel songs are post-emancipation. Gospel songs began early in the 20th century, really. They're northern songs, whereas spirituals are songs of slavery days. And most of the lyrics are from the Bible, Old and New Testament. Didn't my Lord deliver Daniel, and why not every man? A swing low, sweet chariot. And the chariot, of course, is the euphemism for the Underground Railway. And so they were double meanings. The spirituals are, many gospel songs are commercial, quite frankly. But many are quite marvelous. But they represent two different aspects of African-American life, historical aspects. And so that's around and about in that book.
Your relationship with Mahalia, so she really saved you.
Well, and how? I mean, when she said no, that ended the conversation. And they find another Mahalia. Well, we went on. The program went on as usual. We finished our run.
How do you compare the times of then and times of today?
Well, times of today are probably a little worse than then. Then you knew, after all, finally Ed Morrow got at Joe McCarthy. There's an excellent movie coming out, by the way, about Ed Morrow with David Strathairn, a wonderful actor. And I acted in something called 8 Men Out about the Black Sox, who, you know, won last night, the White Sox did, which is quite remarkable. But today, ever since Ronald Reagan's day, quite frankly, the change took place. We have a burlesque of Reagan in George Bush. But as soon as the phrase Reagan Democrats came into being, you knew that race was the base, was one of them. And people, this is ironic, that middle class became the word for everything. The word working class became an alien word. Almost subversive word. No one is working class. We're all middle class. Gore versus Bush did that, as well as Kerry versus Bush. And so it makes it a little more difficult now than it was then. At the same time, we do know, there's a paradox here, we do know, a contradiction in itself, that his popularity has gone down, down, down with the war and with the economy itself. So that's a sign. Just as toward the end of the Vietnam War, remember, kids were beaten up by the jocks, and the jocks finally joined them, too. And that's when LBJ said, I do not choose to run anymore. And so we have that going on at the same time. And that's why those people I call the prescient minority, of which, by the way, you as a broadcaster are one, you don't mind my saying so, have always been a minority. The majority, I'm not going to romanticize the majority. There are certain people in a community who are able to speak articulately They're the same economic stratum, the same religious, the same beliefs. But that woman or that guy is able to articulate what the others may feel.
What do you make of people like Bill O'Reilly of Fox, Pat Robertson calling for the assassination of these leaders?
What can I say about that? It's burlesque, but no longer funny. It isn't funny. Can you imagine someone calling for the assassination of the president, someone foreign? Why, we'd have troops there immediately, bombing the hell out of whatever town it is that harbored those people. So it's twice now. I didn't know the recent one. I knew the one about Pat Robertson, man of God. Man of God. Man represents Jesus Christ. If ever there were an agitator, a labor agitator, he was Jesus Christ, who spoke of, well, we know what he spoke about, rich men and going, you know, having much chance to get to heaven as a camel through a needle's eye. And here's a guy, I'll never forget, there was a preacher I once knew named Claude Williams in the South. He was a marvelous circuit rider, meaning he's a preacher who'd go from church to church. And he was organized Tobacco Workers Union. This was a white union. And this woman who had raggedy blanket around her started, his word was, touched cadence. She touched cadence. She swung. And with Jesus as a labor organizer. And so you have Pat Robertson, who's very unchristian, by the way, in the true sense of the word, to speak of that. So what is to be said that we accept it? I mean, instead of saying, let's dump this guy and dump the reverend thing immediately, we go on. So we live in a strange moment. At the same time, we know the popularity of Reagan is going. Well, I said Reagan, that's interesting. It's a Freudian slip, but nonetheless, this guy is a takeoff on Reagan. He makes Reagan sound like Abraham Lincoln, you know. So the times are, I'm not going to be a Pollyanna. It's this prescient minority that always must speak out, no matter what the dues may be.
Studs Terkel, we're going to break again and then come back with the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, with the legendary broadcaster. Studs Terkel in our studio, the age of 93, just back from heart surgery. Stay with us. Louis Armstrong, Earl Hines, West End Blues here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Studs Terkel, as you listen to Louis Armstrong and write about him, and they all sang. Talk about Louis Armstrong.
Well, if ever there were a favorite jazz recording of mine, it's West End Blues with a Hot 7. He did several versions of it. One including his first wife, Little Hardin Armstrong, is quite marvelous in the book. She speaks of making Louis proud of himself. He came from the orphanage in New Orleans to Chicago. His mentor was King Oliver, whom he worshipped. And she said, worship yourself. But in any event, West End Blues, the version you just played, has Earl Hines at the piano. And he was as much of a pioneer. See, in the case of Louis Armstrong, the horn and the voice were one. You didn't know where one left off, the other began, because the horn was part of his very being. In the case of Earl Hines, he's a trumpet-style piano. So that particular jazz record, and of course they went on from that period of bop, and you've got Dizzy Gillespie talking about work with Charlie Parker and a new form, inventing new forms of the instrument, and then even a Chicago free-form guy named Henry Threadgill. So it was jazz, and Billy, of course, part of it. And then I might go to spirituals and blues and folk, and a 22-year-old kid named Bob Dylan in what may have been one of his earliest radio interviews. And it was a song he wrote, and it was called Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. And he said every line could be the subject of a song, but there's one line that knocked me for a loop. The executioner's face is always well hidden. And you start thinking about that. The hangman and the mask around his face, the guillotine, of course, the hangman and the executioner face. We have today executioners whose faces are not hidden, but they're distant from it. And they may be high officials of a civilized society. And so that line is a fantastic. At first, I thought he meant atomic rain, hard rain. He said, no, no, I mean just rain's going to fall. And it was an interesting interview with this 22-year-old kid at the time.
In your interview with Louis Armstrong, you talk about how it was around midnight. You said we were in the dressing room of a Chicago nightclub. It wasn't one attended by jazz aficionados. Its patrons were usually visiting firemen, merchants gathered at a convention. They were more accustomed to another sort of entertainment, exotic dancers and go-go girls. Armstrong would do. He'd become an international icon, but mostly it was that interpretation of Blueberry Hill, and his grin and his white teeth were much to their liking. Why did he agree to an interview with you?
Well, that's the whole point. He was so loyal to this agent of his, who was not too loyal to him. There was no need for him. He was tired. In fact, I suggested we postpone the interview, because I was worried. You know, his upper lip had a blister the size of a dime. That's impressing the embouchure of the trumpet. So, and he had just come from Ghana, and he spoke of the music of West Africa as being where his stuff came from. He was great. But then you realize how tired he is, how worn he is. And behind that smile, that grin, it's the case of Ernie Banks, the shortstop of the Cubs. The Cubs were one of the last teams to hire black players. And Wrigley, P.K. Wrigley, is the one who was guilty of it. He would say Ernie Banks and his grin. Well, Ernie Banks didn't quite have that grin and neither did Louis Armstrong. He said, oh, they all knew me. I was never invited to the house, but they knew me. So behind that grin was something else. And that's that deep feeling. I remember I was so self-conscious as he took that handkerchief out and had the towel around him. He was so tired. I said, I was suggesting we cut the interview. He says, no, let's keep on. So that's part of it. Sometimes you have to understand also what's happening to the other person.
Moving from Louis Armstrong to James Baldwin, I want to take a listen for a moment to your the collection that you have, Voices of Our Time.
Been trouble taking place in the lowlands at night. I woke up this morning, can't even get out of my door.
Bessie Smith, of course, the Empress of the Blues, singing of a disaster, of a flood. Sitting with me, hearing Bessie Smith on this recording, is James Baldwin, brilliant young American writer. But perhaps a more specific description of Mr. Baldwin, since he is one of the rare men in the world who seems to know who he is today. James Baldwin, brilliant young Negro American writer. And as you listen to this, Jim, to this record of Bessie Smith, What's your feeling?
It's very hard to describe that feeling. The first time I ever heard this record was in Europe, and in very different circumstances than I'd ever listened to Bessie in New York. And what struck me was the fact that she was singing, as you say, about a disaster, which had almost killed her, and she'd accepted it, and was going beyond it. It's a fantastic kind of understatement in it. It's the way I want to write, you know. When she says, "My house fell down and I can't live there no more," it's a great sentence. It's a great achievement.
The way you want to write, you say.
Yeah.
I'm looking now at page 5 of your new book, and it's a remarkable one. Nobody Knows My Name. It's a series of essays, articles, opinions of James Baldwin, more notes of a native son, the subtitle. And on page 5, the reason I'd chosen the Bessie Smith record, because on page 5 you write of your being in Europe, you're in Switzerland.
Yes.
And you said you came armed with 2 Bessie Smith records and a typewriter. And I began to try to recreate the life that I had first known as a child, from which I'd spent so many years in flight. And it was Bessie Smith who, through her tone and her cadence, helped me dig back to the way I myself must have spoken when I was little. And I remember the things I had heard and seen and felt. I buried them deep. I had never listened to Bessie Smith in America. In the same way, for years, I never touched watermelon. But in Europe, you can reconcile myself.
Yes. Well, how can I put that? That winter in Switzerland, I was working on my first novel, which I thought I would never be able to finish. And I finally realized in Europe that one of the reasons that I couldn't finish this novel was because I was ashamed of where I'd come from and where I'd been, and ashamed of the life in the church, and ashamed of my father, ashamed of the blues, and ashamed of jazz, and of course ashamed of watermelon, because it was, you know, all of these stereotypes that the country inflicts on Negroes, that we all eat watermelon, or we all do nothing but sing the blues and all that. Well, I was afraid of all that, and I ran from it. And when I say I was trying to dig back to the way I myself must have spoken when I was little, I realized that I had acquired so many affectations, I had told myself so many lies, that I really had buried myself beneath a whole fantastic image of myself, which wasn't mine, but white people's image of me. And I realized that I had not always talked, obviously I hadn't always talked the way I had forced myself to learn how to talk, and I had to find out what I had been like in the beginning. In order, just technically then, you know, to recreate Negro speech, I realized it was a cadence, it was a beat, much more than, it was not a question of dropping S's or N's or G's, but a question of the beat, really. And Bessie had the beat, you know. And in that, this icy wilderness, you know, as far removed from Harlem as anything you can imagine, with Bessie Smith and me, And white snow, and white mountains, and white faces, who really thought I had been sent by the devil. It was a very strange. They'd never seen a Negro before.
That's James Baldwin, an interview you did with the great writer in 1961.
That was 61. You could tell it was long ago. We said Negro instead of African-American. 61. He had just returned from self-imposed exile in Switzerland. And that was one of the early return interviews he gave of the time. And that's a great title, Nobody Knows My Name. And, of course, that is The Servant for years and years and years. And by the way, there's a marvelous new novel by E.L. Doctorow about Sherman's march through Georgia. That's great. It touches this very theme of the slave being free, and the young mistress, who's an enlightened Southerner, sees her face for the first time as she's now free with a carpet bag in her hand. And she suddenly sees a face she hadn't recognized before, enlightened though she was. So, hearing Baldwin, you hear this voice. I had, by the way, hadn't heard of him until Lorraine Hansberry, who's a Chicagoan, who was my friend, who wrote Raisin in the Sun, brought up the name of this young black writer who will succeed probably Richard Wright, and his name was James Baldwin.
Lorraine Hansberry died very young.
Yeah. Well, Wright, of course, went to Paris to die, and he lost his roots. Richard Wright wrote Native Son, was the first probably great American novel, where Ellison later on wrote Invisible Man. But all sorts of memories are evoked. You talk about the floods, Bessie Smith recalling the floods, and naturally we think of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast and the lack of preparation of this government, in contrast to the New Deal of Franklin D. Roosevelt, who already had plans to stop the floods. And there's a movie, a documentary, I'm surprised no one has picked that up, that was produced by the government. It's called The River, and Virgil Thompson wrote the music, and Tennessee Valley Authority is what it's about. And it was preparation for a disaster that might happen.
Jazz was a lot of, fed you a great deal. As you look at New Orleans now, you know, your first book, The Giants of Jazz, and so many from New Orleans. What do you think about who will get to rebuild New Orleans? The French Quarter certainly will be there, but what about the communities that feed it?
Who knows? That's just the point. There was no preparation at all. We know that now. A guy named Brownie, he's doing a heck of a job, says the clown to him. The second banana says to this guy's the third banana. It's a burlesque show, really, but it's not funny. I don't know what. I mean, there has to be a government, has to be a benign one in this case, to step in fully. You think of all the dough that goes into the wreckage that is Iraq today. The immediate billions and billions, how much of that could be used? Just a portion of that could be used, could have been used to prevent it. Of course, it's, all disasters are preventable, provided there is governmental activity that calls the shot. In the case of the New Deal, Henry Wallace, who was the heart and soul of the New Deal, was Secretary of Agriculture during two terms of Roosevelt, and then he was the Vice President, was a remarkable figure, one of the most attacked and assaulted figures in our history. It was during the Cold War. And I'd say three great Americans of our century, Martin Luther King, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Henry Wallace. I'd put him up there. When Tom Joad says to Ma Joad, remember at the end of Grapes of Wrath, and they're bullied by the vigilantes and the big growers and the legionnaires, they come to a government camp, and it says Farm Security Administration, a subsidiary of the Department of Agriculture, and the director of that camp, who's made up to look like FDR, by the way, wears pince-nez glasses. I remember that small thing. The actor's name was Grant Mitchell. Isn't that funny? Remember the little things. Well, he says, this camp is yours, to the Joad family and to others, to the emigres. This camp is yours, your decision to be made. You do it. We'll help you find jobs. So that was the government that is being dismantled, every aspect of the New Deal.
So what gives you hope today?
What is my hope today?
What gives you hope?
Well, just hope itself. See, without hope, remember the book called Hope Dies Last, the book previous to this one about music. It was Jesse De La Cruz, who was retired as a farm worker in her Mobile home in Fresno, and she worked with Cesar Chavez. She would have a saying in Spanish, when things go bleak, Esperanza muera al último. Hope dies last. Without hope, you become just a cynic, and that's dime a dozen. There has to be that. And I'm not going to be a Pollyanna now. If I don't have that...
We have 5 seconds.
5 seconds are, I have faith in the innate decency and the innate intelligence of the American people that is under unprecedented assault today. That's the biggest assault I know.
Studs Terkel, I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you. It's gone too fast. But thank you, Amy, very much.
And
for doing what you're doing.
Well, that does it for our broadcast. And for all those who make it happen, Mike Burke, Shreve Abdokadoush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, Dennis Moynihan, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.